Dun, dun, dun.
You are listening to the Forgotten News Podcast.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Listeners, if you've ever bought a pair of headphones or earbuds, whether they're cheap or expensive, and then were disappointed to discover that the audio quality was terrible, or that they fit badly or had a crummy design, you won't ever have to worry about that if you buy a pair of headphones or earbuds from Studio Sweden. Just go to studiosweden.com and enter our promo code FORGOTTEN for 15% discount on any purchase and 100% free shipping all over the world.
Hey, 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 it's Carrie, and I host the Sip and Shine podcast. Despite my 13-year-old sounding voice and slight lisp, I invite you to come listen on your favorite podcast catcher, or if you're a little lazy, come check out sipandshinepodcast.com as I chronicle stories of histories, mysteries, scandals, true crime, to cults, ghosts, even a little locked up abroad stories. We probably got your jam, and we aren't judging over here. So of course, because this is an unscholarly podcast, we add in copious amounts of wine, inappropriate humor, candy, and reality TV references. So come pour a glass of wine and sip with me on this Hot Mess Express.
Hello, all of you fantastic listeners. I'm Erica.
And I'm Billy.
And we're the hosts of Martinis and the Macabre,
a comedy podcast discussing morbid murders, mysteries, and mayhem.
No, you don't understand. I was going to try and eat a little bit of her.
I was going to hit
just
her.
Just a nibble.
Do you like true crime?
She killed him and cooked him. Do you wonder about morbid history?
What are you doing with that hammer?
Do you laugh at inappropriate topics?
Open mouth, cut off top of head, and insert both feet and hands.
Then we cordially invite you to our cocktail hour, so you too can build up a tolerance for booze and body bags.
You got a body in these?
Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and most other podcast apps by searching Martinis and the Macabre.
And then sit back and laugh at the worst the world has to offer.
Cheers!
Welcome to the Forgotten News Podcast. This is your window to hear true stories from long ago. Stories that once made headlines. Stories that people thought would be unforgettable. Yet those stories were soon lost in the sands of time or were buried deep in the dustbin of history. In this podcast, we shake off the sand and dust from those stories and share them here with you, as fresh as the day they were first told.
And now, here's your host.
Hello, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for episode 14 of the Forgotten News Podcast. My name is Kit.
My name is Jim, and we host the podcast.
Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this episode, we would first like to thank all of you, our wonderful listeners, for bringing us to a total of over 12,000 downloads since the launch of this podcast.
We also want to thank everyone who listened to our recent mini-episode. It was our 8th mini-episode and one of our all-time most popular.
But you are now listening to a full-length episode, and we think it will be one of our most unique and unusual. Because instead of our typical one or two featured stories, there will be 5 stories.
They are completely unrelated, except for 2 things.
First, they are stories of lynchings that took place in the state of Ohio between the years 1877 and 1932. Second, they are the only stories of lynching incidents in Ohio for which there's very little information available, which is why we are combining them into this one episode.
As many of you already know, I have lived in Ohio for my entire life, and I have previously mentioned on this podcast that I have uncovered the fact that there have been 21 lynchings during the history of this state. I believe that I am the first person to identify the entire list. I have promised to tell the story of each of them on this podcast, and we will be telling several on this episode. Unfortunately, because these particular stories are dark and unpleasant, we will begin with a short warning for our listeners.
This episode will include brief descriptions of violence and tragedy, including incidents with negative racial overtones. However, the specific facts will be kept to the absolute minimum necessary to tell the story in a historically accurate way. This is not a podcast that indulges in gruesome or gory details or foul language in regard to any topic. But even so, if you think that hearing about these things could possibly cause you to have an adverse emotional reaction, then this episode might not be something you should listen to. In addition, this episode might not be appropriate for children since it could be upsetting or even frightening to young ears. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
And now, with all that having been said, I'm with the show.
Our story begins in 1896 in the State Capitol building in Columbus, Ohio.
But not really.
Although it is still important to our story.
In the year 1896, the Ohio legislature passed a law for the specific purpose of preventing and punishing incidents of lynching by allowing the surviving family members of victims, and also anyone who survived an unsuccessful lynching, to sue the county in which a lynching occurred, or the perpetrators of a lynching, or both, for money damages. This law also requires the county to be automatically held liable for any death or other harm suffered by the victim or the family of the victim simply for the fact that the lynching occurred in that county. At the time it was passed, it was the strongest anti-lynching law ever passed by any state. And as far as I know, it might still be the strongest. It has never been repealed, and it can be used at any time that anyone is the victim or an attempted victim of any type of serious unlawful violence by a mob.
In other words, a lynching does not have to be a hanging or an attempted hanging. And this definition reflected the common understanding of the word lynching in the 19th and early 20th century. It was not until many decades later, primarily because of horrific images in movies and TV shows, that most people began to think of lynching as meaning a hanging of a person by an angry mob, when it actually means any type of mob violence.
Anyway, the reason we are mentioning this information is because
Three of the five incidents
on this episode
were lynchings as defined by Ohio law and the common public understanding at the time.
Specifically, mob violence that did not end with a hanging, but did end with a death of a human being.
And with that being said, we will now move on to our first story.
Take it away, Kit.
Thank you, Jim. During the first week of September 1877, numerous newspapers across the United States reported a short news item that a man named Simeon Garnett had been lynched for, quote, committing an outrage and an assault upon Mrs. Perry Kingry, the wife of a farmer residing near Oxford, Ohio, unquote. The articles regarding the incident, every single one, mentions the fact that Mr. Garnett was black. None of the articles mention the race of Mrs. Kingry, so it is probably a reasonable assumption that she was white. The information I have mentioned so far is virtually all of the information that we were able to find. This is even true in regard to the New York Times, which also published a very skeletal story, despite the fact that it is generally considered the gold standard of American journalism. Even more unfortunately, notwithstanding the awesome power of the internet, we were only able to uncover a few additional facts, notwithstanding a great deal of digging and searching. First, in regard to the man who was lynched, he was 20 years old at the time of this incident, according to U.S. Census records. His actual name was Simeon, not Simon, and his last name, Garnett, was spelled with one T, not two. Please be aware that there were a few newspaper articles here and there which did report his name correctly, but the vast majority did not. Garnett was born in Kentucky in 1857. It was a state that permitted human slavery prior to the end of the Civil War in 1865, so it is very possible that he may have been a slave or an escaped slave previous to moving to Ohio. These are literally all of the facts which we were able to find regarding the short life and background of Simeon Garnett prior to the incident in Oxford, Ohio, which led to his death. Oxford is located in Butler County, approximately 40 miles or 64 kilometers northwest of Cincinnati. Now, moving on to the rest of the story. Here is what we know, based on all the verifiable facts that we have been able to find. On the evening of Saturday, September 1st, 1877, according to the New York Times and various other newspaper reports published at the time, Mrs. Perry Kingry was the victim of, quote, an outrage and an assault, unquote. None of the articles contain any details as to where it happened. That is, whether it was at her house or on a dark street in town, or at whatever other place it might have been. In any event, Garnett was accused of the crime. This allegation in the 19th century was a genteel way of saying that he was alleged to have committed rape or an attempted rape against Mrs. Kingry. By the way, we attempted to find some additional information about Mrs. Kingry, but we could not find a single thing. Absolutely nothing. But we were able to determine that Perry Kingry was indeed a real person because he is listed in the 1860 U.S. Census for Ohio. However, for whatever reason, his name is not in any U.S. Census after that year. But since we know he was 5 years old in 1860, we were able to calculate that he was 26 in 1877, so we can safely assume that his wife, at the time, was probably in her early 20s also. The town where the crime took place, Oxford, Ohio, was a small town with a population of only approximately 1,800 people. It would have been one of those little places where everybody knew everybody else, including Mrs. Kingery and Simeon Garnett, which is probably why he was quickly identified as the perpetrator. He was arrested and jailed on the same evening as the assault. The following day, September 2nd, at noon, a mob of quote-unquote infuriated men broke into the jail and shot Garnett, but not fatally. The next day, September 3rd, according to the New York Times, quote, "The mob returned at noon and took the prisoner out of the jail and shot him dead," unquote. And unfortunately, that is all the information that we were able to uncover in regard to this incident. But the strangest aspect of the story is that even though this incident took place in Ohio, we were unable to find any Ohio newspaper that even mentioned the story, other than the Cincinnati Inquirer. However, the Inquirer merely quoted word for word the same bare-bones story that was in the New York Times and many other newspapers. The original source is unidentified. And sadly, these few random details are all that we, or anyone, will know about this story, until such time as someone in Butler County happens to take the time to dig up the local newspapers from 1877, or perhaps old records from the police or the courts, and finds the full story, and decides to share it. So, with that being said, I will now turn things over to Jim to tell the next story.
Thank you, Kit. Our next story takes place in Geauga County, Ohio, on November 21st, 1877, only a few months after the lynching of Simeon Garnett. On that date, in the rural community of Middlefield, which is located approximately 45 miles or 72 kilometers south of Cleveland, a 22-year-old man named Luther Scott was arrested on a charge of burglary by a constable and two deputies from Middlefield. He had been found while hiding in a strip of woods on the outskirts of town. According to U.S. Census records, Scott was white and a lifelong resident of the town. He was widely believed to be a member of a criminal gang that had committed numerous burglaries in Geauga County. Sometime on their way back to the village, Scott and the officers were stopped by a group of 20 masked men who threatened them with guns and rifles. The men grabbed the officers, tied them up, and gagged their mouths. Then they hung Luther Scott from a tree. The officers were not injured, except for embarrassment. And after the masked men left, the officers successfully loosened themselves, returned to town, and gave a general alarm to the public. It appears that the masked men were never identified. However, based on most newspaper articles from the time, there seems to have been a widespread opinion that these men were members of the gang who wanted to either scare or kill Scott to prevent him from revealing the identities of any of the other members of the gang. It is entirely understandable that many people believed that other members of the gang might have a suspicious opinion of Scott, because he apparently had a reputation in town as, quote, an untrustworthy person, unquote. But, according to other newspaper reports, the masked men supposedly identified themselves as being members of a vigilance committee and had strung him from the tree several times to force a confession that he was one of the men who had robbed a clothing store in Middlefield on November the 15th. Some newspapers believed that the members of this so-called vigilance committee were actually several local businessmen and homeowners who had been victims of the recent series of burglaries. However, it is also possible that the committee was simply other members of the gang, acting under pretense and merely trying to see if Scott would spill the beans under pressure. But at this late date, over 140 years later, it does not appear that there is any way to know for certain who the masked men really were. In addition, there are contradictory reports in newspapers from the time as to whether Luther Scott had died from being hung from the tree. There are at least two newspaper articles which report that he was taken down, resuscitated, and then given a medical exam by physicians who declared that he would recover with treatment of his injuries. I am highly doubtful about the articles which say that Scott did not die in the lynching, mainly because there was not even one newspaper article regarding Luther Scott that was ever published in the aftermath of the incident other than the initial reports in the 2 days that followed the attack by the masked men. Also, you can find Luther Scott in the 1870 census, but not in the 1880 or 1900 census, although his parents and siblings are listed. But, unfortunately, that is all the information that we have. And because of that lack of information, we have now reached the conclusion of the story of Luther Scott, since we have nothing else that we can say, either about him or the incident. So, I will now step aside, and my co-host Kit will tell the next story.
Thank you, Jim. I will now tell the story of a quote-unquote lynching in 1892 in Millersburg, Ohio, a small town in Holmes County, approximately 82 miles or 131 kilometers south of Cleveland. There are numerous websites and online articles which say as a fact that there was a lynching of an unknown black man on April 1st, 1892 in Millersburg. But here's the story behind the story. This alleged incident is a rabbit hole that takes you nowhere. If you do a cursory search on the internet, all that you will find at first are a handful of articles and blog posts, all written a century or more after 1892. Which are basically trash talk against Millersburg, as supposedly being a village of white trash racists throughout its long history. For example, one writer claimed, without providing any evidence, that Millersburg was a sundown town, meaning that any black person who stayed in the village after dark was unlikely to still be alive in the morning. However, once you do more than a cursory search and look through actual Ohio newspapers from the year 1892, it will soon become clear that the alleged lynching was just that, an alleged lynching. It appears that what really happened was an April Fool's joke that was not very funny, and especially not in the present day. Here's what actually seems to have happened. A man named Albert Lothar, a 35-year-old painter, had a cast iron lawn ornament. a small statue of a black man holding a lantern. Ornaments of this type were very popular lawn decorations throughout the 19th and most of the 20th century in the United States. Anyway, on the night of March 31st, 1892, according to a newspaper called the Holmes County Farmer and also the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a group of quote-unquote night prowlers decided to play a practical joke on Mr. Lowther by hanging his statue from a tree in his yard, as if it were a black man being lynched. The next day, these same knuckleheads went into town telling people that a black man had been lynched from a tree at Albert Lowther's house. Well, long story short, a lot of people took this fake story very seriously, and it quickly spread far beyond Millersburg.
Beginning
with articles that were published in newspapers in Columbus, Ohio, and later other random places throughout the state and the nation. Unfortunately, since fake news is the first draft of fake history, this fake story has persisted, and as we mentioned earlier, the alleged lynching of an unknown black man in Millersburg can still be found on many websites dealing with the history of lynching in America, despite zero evidence. On the other hand, as a counterbalance, we feel a need to mention the fact that the article in Holmes County Farmer, in describing the lawn ornament of a black man holding a lantern, did not use the phrase black man. It used the N-word. So it is entirely possible that the story of the so-called April Fool's joke might have just been fake information to cover up an actual lynching to prevent discovery and prosecution. And at this late date, we have absolutely no way to know for certain. So that is the story of the alleged Millersburg lynching. Because there is nothing else that we can say. We simply have no additional information. And that is that. We will now therefore move on, and Jim will tell you the next story.
Thank you, Kit. We will now move on to the story of a very different incident, for which we have possibly the least amount of information of any of our stories. But we will move ahead anyway, despite the fact that the available details are very minimal. And with that disclaimer, we will now share the information that we do have. On July 13, 1920, a steamship named the City of Toledo was traveling from Duluth, Minnesota to Toledo, Ohio. The crew on the ship included a chef named Milton Harris, a 33-year-old African-American man. And at some point, the ship crossed into the waters of Ohio. Now, the story of what happened next is extremely vague. The most information that we were able to find was contained in the 1920 annual report of the NAACP, which was published in January 1921. This report includes a list of every known incident in which any individual was killed by violence committed by a mob during that year, 1920, in the United States. And one of those incidents occurred on the steamship. Something happened. We don't know what exactly, but the end result, according to the NAACP report, was that Milton Harris was, quote, drowned by deckhands in retaliation for an attack on a white boy, unquote. A similar description is contained in a newspaper called the Ironton Daily Globe of Ironton, Minnesota, which was one of the very few reportings of the event that we could find online that was published during the time period in which it happened. Unfortunately, that short bit of information leaves so much unsaid that I am not sure what to say, and so, nearly 100 years later, I am not going to speculate about what might have happened. But it is possible that an entirely different set of events may have occurred. According to the Cincinnati Enquirer of July 15, 1920, in a story with a dateline from Toledo, the death of Mr. Harris resulted in the arrest and jailing of several men. However, the incident was then investigated by the coroner, who interviewed eyewitnesses. I assume this was the coroner of Lucas County, where Toledo is located. In any event, his inquest confirmed that there had, indeed, been a physical scuffle between Harris and some sailors. However, according to the coroner's verdict, based on eyewitness testimony, this fight took place on the dock in Toledo, not on the ship, and that Harris was not thrown overboard, but had fallen off the dock in the heated excitement of the moment and had drowned because he did not know how to swim and no one was able to reach him in time to save him from death. Hence, as a result, it was the ruling of the coroner that the death of Milton Harris was, quote, an unavoidable accident, unquote. So, in response to this verdict, the charges against the men who had been arrested were dropped by the prosecutor. They were then released. And, sad to say, that is all we know about this incident. We don't know which version of the story is true, and we don't know who the eyewitnesses were. We don't know if they were telling the truth. We don't know if they were lying. We weren't there. And it truly makes us sad and annoyed to say that despite spending many hours looking for additional information regarding this story, we were unable to find anything beyond what we have just told you. So, with that being said, my lovely and talented co-host Kit will now begin our next story.
Thank you, Jim. This is the story of Luke Marion, which is another tragic historical incident which is lacking in details. But once again, we will tell you as much as we have been able to find. Here's what we do know. According to newspaper reports from the time, in June of 1932, Luke Marion was 35 years old. He was an African American, and he was employed as a chauffeur for Howard Daines of Atlanta, Georgia.
But, for some reason, on June 7th of that year, he was in the small village of South Point in Lawrence County, Ohio, which is about 10 miles west of Huntington, West Virginia.
And just as a side note, there is a very odd thing in regard to all of the articles we found that describe this location. None of them, not even one, mentions the close proximity of the fairly large city of Huntington. But instead, they refer to the much lesser known town of Ironton, which is about 10 miles northwest of South Point, and much smaller than Huntington. Very strange. But it is what it is.
Now, I mentioned previously that on June 7th, Luke Marion was in the small town of South Point, Ohio. In fact, it was very small. In 1932, it had a population of about 500 people.
Oh.
A few days later, on June 10th, Luke Marion was found dead.
One thing that is entirely unmentioned in the newspaper reports that were published at the time is why Luke Marion was in South Point in the first place.
My first thought was that Luke Marion might have been from South Point, or somewhere else nearby, and that he may have been on vacation, visiting his family. But looking at U.S. Census records from 1920 and 1930, there is no black family with the name of Marion living anywhere in southern Ohio. So it is unlikely that Luke was from that area.
We mentioned previously that in 1932, Luke Marion was working as a chauffeur for someone named Howard Daines of Atlanta, Georgia, whom we are going to guess was some sort of businessman. And if Howard was a businessman, or perhaps some sort of traveling salesman, that might have been the reason why Luke was in South Point. He may simply have been driving Howard Daines through Ohio on a business trip or a sales trip, and at some point, they ended up in South Point, for whatever unknown reason.
Now, according to the U.S. Census for 1930, there was only one family named Daines in the state of Georgia. There was no Howard listed, but it is possible that the newspaper reporter may have gotten the first name wrong. Or perhaps, if Howard Daines was a businessman or a traveling salesman, he might just have been out of town on the day that the census was being taken at his house.
Please keep in mind, in those days, the U.S. government didn't mail the census forms to people to fill out. They would send employees called enumerators, or the more common name, census takers, who would then interview people at the door to their home or apartment. And if you weren't at home when the census taker showed up, well, you simply didn't get counted in that year's census. So that might be the reason why Howard Daines isn't listed in the census for 1930. But in any event, this is all just guesswork on our part.
So let's get back to actual facts, as reported at the time. On or about June 7th, 1932, Luke Marion was arrested and jailed in South Point for threatening two white men with a knife during a fight. Their names were Ben Hall and John Ballard, and according to the 1930 U.S. Census, they were both in their 30s, and their occupation was simply listed as laborer.
We do not know what the fight was about, or who started the fight, or why Luke Marion decided to pull a knife. However, please keep in mind that this was a town with very few black people. So it is possible that Luke was jumped by a couple of dirt poor white racists who were simply jealous of a black man with a good job. And thus, he might have taken out the knife and waved it around entirely in self-defense. But who knows? This scenario is entirely hypothetical.
The facts surrounding the fight are unknown, because there were no details printed in any news article, except that it was widely reported that there was a crowd of white people nearby watching the scuffle, and that they became enraged after the knife was pulled. Notwithstanding the fact that Luke Marion was all by himself in a battle with two other men, he may have just wanted them to back off, and that could have been the sole reason for him drawing the knife.
Anyway, regardless of the details surrounding the fight, Luke was arrested and jailed for threatening the men with the knife. Unfortunately, this outcome was not enough for the angry crowd, and for whatever reason, the rage of the mob only intensified over the next 2 days until it reached a fever pitch on Friday, June 10th, when a large mob gathered and broke through the flimsy door of the jail. According to the Cincinnati Inquirer, they met no resistance, found the keys to the cells, and Luke was taken out of the jail. He was thereupon flogged with a whip and quote-unquote ordered to disappear.
However, he apparently did not disappear fast enough to satisfy the mob, because the next day, his body, badly battered, was found in a nearby river by a fisherman.
The sheriff immediately launched a murder investigation in coordination with the coroner, who announced that he would begin an inquest the next day to determine the cause of death. The sheriff further declared that many residents of South Point would be questioned to find the members of the mob who committed the raid on the jail.
According to the 1930 annual report of the NAACP, 4 white men were very quickly arrested. 12 others were under suspicion, and 6 men were later indicted. Unfortunately, we have been unable to find any further information.
We do not know whether Luke Marion was hung, shot, stabbed, or drowned. We also do not know whether any of the accused men were ultimately found guilty. And because of that lack of information, we are now at the end of the story of the life and death of Luke Marion. At least as much as we were able to find. We can only hope that someone out there with access to more information will someday uncover the rest of the story.
Now, with that in mind, we will say this. Although this is a very sad and tragic story, there is one, and only one, positive aspect to it. It is the last known incident of lynching in the state of Ohio. And that being the case, it is also good to know that the perpetrators of the death of Luke Marion were arrested and hopefully punished for their crime.
And with that having been said, we will now wrap up this quintuplet of horrible stories from history and move on to the next segment of this episode.
As we promised on our recent mini-episode, we will now be presenting a police blotter and court news column from a random date in the 19th century as part of this episode. And so, here we go.
Our guest narrator this time is Amelia Labibar, the co-host of Pitney and Amelia's Bitchin' Boutique podcast. And this particular police blotter and court news column was published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer on March 1st, 1869. One last thing we think we should mention before the start of the segment. You will hear descriptions of defendants being sentenced to paying fines that might sound small, but keep in mind that $1 in 1869 is equal to approximately $18 in the present day. So a fine of $2 would still be pretty substantial. And with that being said, we will step out of the way and move on.
Police blotter and court news.
Municipal Court, Cleveland, Ohio. March 1st, 1869.
Order in the court. Order in the court.
Emma Lewis, Kate Caneo, and Martha Carroll, charged with being drunk in public. They were sent to the workhouse for 30 days. William Farrell, charged with disturbance, was fined $2. Ann Joyce and Mike Gaffney, charged with being drunk in public. They were each fined $2. Sam Beach, charged with vagrancy, was sentenced to the workhouse for 3 months. Ed Perkins and James Dean, charged with being drunk in public. They were sentenced to pay court costs with fines waived. Morris Gill was bound over the Court of Common Pleas, charged with burglary. He stepped into the domicile of Maria French and carried away a small amount of washed clothing, but late enough in the evening to make the crime burglary. John Meyer, charged with violating the street ordinance. His case was continued until June 22nd. O.A. Wood, a suspicious person, was given 30 days to leave the city. He figured rather extensively in the municipal court a few months ago, when he was charged with incest, the person with whom he cohabitated being a stepdaughter 14 years of age. The charge was brought by the mother of the girl, whom it was claimed was not the wife of Wood, notwithstanding her declaration that she was. After an absence of several months, during which time Wood has been in Detroit, Windsor, and other places in that direction, he turned up in Cleveland on Friday. He appears to have plenty of money. The police arrested him on suspicion and gave him 24 hours to leave the city. Under a city ordinance, he will be obliged to go, no matter what reformation he may make, or he will make himself subject to arrest and imprisonment as a suspicious person, unless the officers choose to let him go about his business. The ordinance can be abused. Orrin D. Thomas, John S. Waterbury, John Dewey, and Theodore Paulson, charged with being drunk in public. Their cases were dismissed by the prosecution, and they were then discharged by the court.
I hereby declare this court is adjourned.
And that brings us to the end of the police blotter and court news of March 1st, 1869.
We hope that you enjoyed having this brief opportunity to spend some time on the side streets, country roads, and back alleys of the past.
These stories are always fascinating to me. These are people whose names you would never have known.
Definitely.
They are real people who once walked the streets of town.
Yep.
In modern times, we sometimes hear the phrase, the good old days. Well, the good old days were filled with a lot of people who were less than perfect. And this segment of our podcast enables you to meet some of them, warts and all.
Absolutely.
I would like to think that, perhaps, by getting their names printed in the newspaper way back then, maybe it might have been the thing that got them to turn their life around. Maybe they stopped running a brothel or stopped getting drunk. Maybe they didn't get into fights anymore over every little thing. Well, anyway, that is what I'd like to believe.
By the way, listeners, we would very much like to tell police blotter stories from the 19th century newspapers of other places.
If any of you, our listeners, have the time and ability, just email one to us from your city or town, and we promise to use it. The address is forgottennewspodcast at www.thefurgottennews.com.
But at this time, we would like to thank
Amelia Lobby Barr, host of a silly little podcast called Pitney and Amelia's Bitchin' Boutique,
for being the narrator of the police blotter and court news column on this episode, and
Robin Warder of The Trail Went Cold
for voicing the introductory title of the segment.
And now, with all of that having been said,
if you are a fan of the show, please be sure to go to iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, and rate, review, and subscribe to the Forgotten News Podcast. We prefer a 5-star review, by the way. It definitely helps us to attract new listeners. Plus, getting nice reviews helps motivate us to keep producing new episodes. So, thanks in advance for your ratings and reviews.
By the way, speaking of thanks, we will, as usual, thank Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for the music used on this episode, and freesound.org for the sound effects. Thanks, guys.
We've included specific credits for him and his music in the show notes, which you can find on our website, www.forgottennewspodcast.podbean.com, or just go to Google and simply type Forgotten News Podcast Podbean. It will take you right there.
Now, this is normally the point in the show where we ask our listeners to help us out by making a financial contribution.
But this time, instead, we're just going to ask you to buy some merchandise to help support us. Like a t-shirt, a mug, a tote bag, a pillow, or a phone case featuring our logo, or even just a sticker.
We aren't sure how many of our listeners understand that although you are getting free entertainment from this podcast, it is not free for us to produce it.
We have to pay for our recording equipment and for the monthly charges of the hosting company that distributes the podcast, which is how you happen to be able to hear the show in the first place. So we'd truly appreciate if you, our listeners, could at least help us to offset those expenses, because if nothing else, it would make it a lot more fun for us to put episodes out for you. And it's the only way that I'll know you actually care. So here's what I'd like you to do. Show us some love. Just go to teepublic.com. That's teepublic.com. And use the search feature to type Forgotten News Podcast as one word. Then make a purchase, and you'll not only have a nice t-shirt, mug, tote bag, notebook, pillow, or whatever else you choose, but you'll also be helping us too, because every sale gives us a few bucks to offset our time and expense and to help keep the podcast going strong.
And if your significant other is a fan of our show, buy them something.
However, if your significant other doesn't want to buy you any of our merch, then maybe you might need a new significant other. Just saying. You know, maybe. But on the other hand, if you'd like to help us out by buying something for yourself or for anyone else, including your significant other, just go to teepublic.com hit the search bar and type in Forgotten News Podcast as one word. The rest is up to you.
Another thing that you can do to support us is to give us your feedback. Give us your comments, suggestions, ideas, thoughts, and anything you might like to say in regard to this episode or any of our past episodes or mini episodes or about the show in general.
So, with that in mind, our email address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to type that as all one word. There are no hyphens, dashes, or underscores. You can also find the Forgotten News Podcast on Facebook and Twitter. Just type Forgotten News Podcast as three words into the search box and you can find us. It's very easy. But please take note, the Twitter handle for our podcast is @newsforgotten and not Forgotten News. Jim tweets and answers tweets from there. But if any of our listeners would like to follow or contact me on Twitter, my handle is @KitKaren, spelled KitKaren, as if it were all one word. I'd love to hear from you. So anyway, please feel free to use any of those methods to interact with us.
I think that is pretty much everything for this episode of the podcast.
I guess this is the end.
So, with that being said, goodbye, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
And remember, history is no mystery.
Thank you for listening to the Forgotten News Podcast. You will now be returned back to the present day, and we hope that we can count on you to join us for our next episode.
The disadvantage of not knowing the past is that we do not know the present. History is a hill or high mountain. It is the only point from which men and women can see the entirety of the town in which they live and the age in which they are living.